for the sake of those of you who are new with us, I want to briefly review something, and then for the sake of those of you who are simply returning, I'll review it also, but for a different purpose. We've been in the life of Jesus now for some, 6 or 8 weeks, I guess. And we've come now to the 6th chapter of the book of John. And we've noticed in the first 4 chapters the time of Jesus' life that was easy and uncomplicated. It was spent in social contact with people. Then we noticed a change more or less in the scene in chapter 5 as Jesus clashed with the religious leaders of his day. And now in chapter 6 we come to another point in his life. I've entitled this lesson tonight, "My Kingdom is Not of This World." Now I know that ordinarily we think of this expression as being connected with the conversation that Jesus held with Pilate at the time of his trial in John 18. And that is where Jesus made this verbatim statement, "My kingdom is not of this world." And that's where John records it. But another occasion, much more critical, where Jesus made this statement not in words but in actions, is found here in the 6th chapter of John. And the event in the 6th chapter of John is much more important than that one that's described in his conversation with Pilate. I don't know whether Pilate believed Jesus or not, as Jesus disclaimed any hope or any design for an earthly kingdom. Indications are that Pilate did believe him, but it didn't make any difference then whether he did or not. He lost his life. But the ramifications that are connected with this 6th chapter of John are so totally more important than that conversation with Pilate that they totally eclipse that occasion. They totally eclipse that conversation to where actually all Jesus was doing when he told Pilate, "My kingdom is not of this world," was reaffirming something that he had definitely set out in this occasion that's recorded in John the 6th chapter. So he was telling Pilate nothing more than he'd said to these people here. But this is where it really made a difference, and the ramifications here are very meaningful. I want to briefly outline chapter 6 for you, verses 1 through 15. I'm going to ask you to do something. Put one finger in John 15, John 6, and leave it there. Open now to Mark the 6th chapter, and let's make sure that that's open. And if you'd like to open one to Matthew the 14th chapter, you may do that. We'll be working primarily out of these 3 passages. And all of these are parallels. In fact, if you wanted to get the 4th parallel, you'd turn to Luke 9. We'll mention this in a few moments, but something happened in John 6, 1 through 15. Something critical happened there. And what it was, we're going to defer until just a few moments and look at it in its historical context. But that happened in John 6, 1 through 15 is so pivotal that after that period of time, we sense, even during that period of time, we sense a tension and a crisis period. For example, in John 6 and verses 6 and 16 and 17, immediately after that verse 15, John records the disciples' departure in a boat. But that's all he says. They went down and got in a boat and went across the sea. But Mark gives us a greater insight into it. And that passage that's in Mark chapter 6 says that Jesus compelled his disciples to get in the boat and go over before him. And he uses the word, and it was translated in the Revised Standard, "he made them." But that word "made" that Mark uses here in the Greek language is so strong. It's so very strong, anankazo, anankazo. And the very word itself, even just saying it, anankazo, it's harsh. But that's not the way you get the use of it. The word is used in such a strong way in the New Testament, and it isn't used often. For example, it was used by the Apostle Paul as he stood before Agrippa and described his relationship to the Christians that he had persecuted. He said he persecuted them in all the synagogues, and compelled them to blaspheme. The word there being in the context, you might even think of torture. That it was that kind of urgent, compelling, constraining of them. He absolutely forced them to blaspheme. That's the same word that's used here. Now you'll want to notice that no other time, on no other occasion, is Jesus described by the gospel writers as using such force or such urgency on his disciples or on anybody else. Only on this occasion here. Now Mark uses that word. The thing that makes it underlined, and you know it, you're on the right track, is that in Matthew, the 14th chapter, and in verse 22, the parallel account there that Matthew records, same event, whenever Matthew described this, the force that Jesus used to get his disciples to leave, Matthew uses the same verb identically. It's the same word. So you see, the only two times where it is said of Jesus that he used such force on his disciples was one in Mark and the other in Matthew, recording the very same incident. Now that's got to be meaningful. And so we see this point of crisis, we see this point of tension existing here. But something else. In Mark the 6th chapter in verse 46, we find that immediately after that, Jesus went up into the hills to pray. Now Mark doesn't record Jesus going to pray very often. He doesn't record him kneeling to pray, or he just doesn't mention it much. In fact, he only mentions it three times. Once he mentions it in chapter 1, at the beginning of his ministry, it says that he prayed and his disciples came out early in the morning and found him, and they said, everybody's wanting to see you, but he said, I've got to go on to some other cities, that's why I've come. But he was there in prayer. The other two times, one in Mark 6 and the other in Mark 15, where Jesus, in Mark 6, it was on this occasion here, after sending these people away, after sending his disciples into a ship and sending them across the sea, and after dismissing the crowd, it says that he went up into the hills to pray. The other time that Mark records was that time when Jesus was in the Garden of Gethsemane. And as he took Peter, James, and John and went apart and then left them there and went on further into the garden, and there he prayed prior to his trial and to his crucifixion. But not only that, Matthew records Jesus praying even fewer times than that. Matthew doesn't tell that Jesus prayed but twice. Would you believe that one of those is this occasion here when he sent the crowd away after feeding the 5,000? Matthew says Jesus went up into the mountains or the hills to pray. And the other time is the same one that Mark records, was in the Garden of Gethsemane when Jesus there fell on his face and prayed. Matthew only uses and tells of those two occasions of prayer. Now that also, I believe, is meaningful. Both of these occasions being obviously ones that were associated with great stress and real trial and real crisis. So you find these two indications of stress and crisis. The fact that this word was used to describe the urgency and the compelling force that he used to get his disciples out of here. It's almost a violent word. It's one of great intensity. And then the fact that after it was over, he got off and by himself and went away and prayed. Now that's got to be meaningful, but something else. This particular event is so pivotal that you see developing a sense of estrangement between Jesus and the people. Now, I'm talking about the common people. These weren't religious leaders here. These were the common people. But something happened in John 6, 1 through 15 that is so pivotal that after this, you see this sense of estrangement develop. You see this sense, a barrier is thrown up between Jesus and the common people. And it is an estrangement between Jesus and the people and between the people and Jesus. It's a common thing. Let me fill you in just a brief moment on the circumstances of this whole chapter. Verses 1 through 15 of chapter 6 of John take place on the northeast shore of the Sea of Galilee. Then, if you'll just include then verse 16 on through the end of the chapter, which is about verse 71 of John 6, into the 7, I think it's verse 71. The rest of this takes place in Capernaum, around the synagogue, and even in the synagogue. You see, after Jesus dismissed the crowd, having sent his disciples on, forced them to get in the boat and leave, he dismissed the crowd, he went up into the hills to pray, the people saw that he did not leave with his disciples. And yet the next morning he wasn't there either. So they hailed down some boats that were coming from Tiberias. They flagged them down, got on the boats, and came on over to the city of Capernaum and found Jesus there in the environs of Capernaum. And they asked him this silly question, really. It's very shallow. Makes you almost yick to even read it. They said, "Lord, when did you come over here?" Well, they were interested, no doubt, and they were confused as to how he got there. Of course, he had walked across the water. He had defied the law of gravity and just walked across the sea. He didn't tell them that. But there's this sense of estrangement. Now, watch how he answers them. He says, and let's look in chapter 15. I'm just going to point out several look at verse 25 and 26 and 27 of John 6. When they found him on the other side of the sea, they said to him, "Rabbi, when did you come here?" Jesus answered them, "Truly, truly, I say to you, you seek me not because you saw signs, but because you ate your fill of the loaves." And that's quite a stinging rebuke, especially when you consider that the same crowd that he talked to here in such a stinging rebuke was the very crowd that Matthew says that Jesus had compassion on them, and he saw them as sheep without a shepherd and began to teach them many things. But he rebuked them here. He said, "You're following me just because you had your belly full of loaves, not because you saw signs." And then look again in verse 27. "Don't labor for food that perishes, but for the food which endures to eternal life." And then look at verse 36. "But I said to you that you have seen me and yet do not believe." He accused them here of unbelief. In verses 43 and 44, Jesus said, "Do not murmur among yourselves." He rebuked them for murmuring. Verse 44, "No one can come to me unless the Father who sent me draws him." There's this detachment as far as Jesus and his estrangement from the people. There's this detachment that appears. He just simply says, "You're unbelievers. You're following me because you had your belly full." And he says, you need to quit murmuring. And nobody can come to me anyway unless the Father that sent me draws him. So there's this estrangement in the form of a detachment. There's a coolness. There's an aloofness that develops here. But on the part of the people, their estrangement from Jesus can be seen in the sense of a defection begins to develop. They began to defect. Look at these verses here in verse 41 of chapter 6. "The Jews then murmured at him because he said, 'I am the bread which came down from heaven.' They were offended at that. And then it develops on into verse 52. "The Jews then disputed among themselves, saying, 'How can this man give us his flesh to eat?' They got kind of riled up. They were offended at that. And then verse 60, many of the disciples, when they heard it, said, 'This is a hard saying. Who's going to listen to that, or who can hear this?' Verse 66 says, after this, many of his disciples drew back and no longer went about with him." Now you see this defection developing. Now look, this, if you'll read it in its context and read it in view of the parallel passages in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, this represents a very decided break in the atmosphere. This represents a very decided break in the tenor of the time. And here, all of a sudden, you see this chopping off of a cordial relationship. It seems like the battle line was drawn. And Jesus is saying, "All right, here it is. You've made yourselves known. I've made myself known. Now, this is where it is, and I'm going to tell you something." And that's when he, in essence, says, "My kingdom is not of this world." My kingdom is not of this world. It's another kind. Now, but what was it that happened in verses 1 through 15? These are some of the results that came about, this estrangement, this detachment, this defection. But what was it in the world that happened in those first 15 verses that so caused this turn of events? Something happened there. Well, there was the feeding of the 5,000. But that's not anything. He had fed others before. But then if you look in verse 15, they attempted to forcefully make him king. At least they were getting ready to. And no doubt he had seen them standing around maybe in small groups saying, "All right, this is it. Let's go." And it says when Jesus detected that they were going to come and make him king by force, then that's when he dismissed his disciples and then dismissed the group and went off into the mountains to pray. But what is all that saying? What are the implications in the fact that this is the only sign, this is the only miracle that Jesus performed of all of his miracles that is recorded in all four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John? Matthew, the 14th chapter, Mark, the 6th chapter, Luke, the 9th chapter, and John, the 6th chapter. All four of them recorded. That's significant. It's significant that when Jesus made his disciples get in that boat and leave, it's significant that this very strong word is used, which Jesus has never described as using such force on his disciples or anybody else ever again on any other occasion, only this one. And the fact that here, of one of two occasions, of major occasions, where it says that he went off into the hills to pray, what are the implications of this? Well, I think it'll have to be said that in the Gospels that we find the implications that they are contained there, but they're not explained. Now, in order to understand it, you're going to have to see the mindset of the Jew of that day. And that's what I really want to do tonight, is to give you the mindset of the Jewish person of the day of Christ that he lived, so that you can understand some of the struggles that Jesus went through in trying to bring these people to an understanding of the Messiahship. These people had a certain mindset. It is contained in the Gospels. For example, flip quickly back to Luke, the third chapter, and verse 15. In Luke 3:15, this is the introduction to John's ministry. It says there that as the people were in expectation, they were expecting. Well, what were they expecting? It says, as they were in expectation, and all men questioned in their hearts concerning John, whether perhaps he were the Christ. So you see, here was this atmosphere, this whole background that had been developing and had been mounting to such a fever pitch, and these people were in expectation about whether or not perhaps John were the Christ. John says, I'm not the Christ. This is more fully developed over in John, the first chapter, where the leaders of the Jews come to John and say, are you the Christ? And he said, no, I'm not the Christ. Well, then are you Elijah? No. Well, are you the prophet? No. But you see, here they sent this ambassage from the Jewish leaders in Jerusalem. They asked John, who are you? They were looking for the Christ. Now, all of this, you see, is contained in the Gospels. It's contained there, but it's not explained. For example, in Matthew, the 16th chapter, do you remember when Jesus was asking them, he was feeling them out, trying to find out what rumors were going around about him? He said, who do men say that I, the Son of Man, am? They said, well, some are saying you're John the Baptist, others, Jeremiah, one of the prophets. And then he said, who do you say that I am? And Peter said, you're the Christ, you're the Messiah. But then in verses 21, 2, and 3 of Matthew 16, Simon Peter lets us know that he doesn't know the Messiah from Adam's house cat. He didn't have a faintest clue as to who the Messiah really was. Because when Jesus, it says, began at that point to teach them that he must go up to Jerusalem and suffer many things and be put to death by the hands of the rulers and then be raised on the third day, Simon Peter had the audacity to take him aside and began to rebuke him, indicating that Simon didn't understand the nature of the Messiah, not God's Messiah, not at all. So we find that they didn't understand. Simon didn't understand. In Acts 1 and about verse 8, when they ask, are you now going to restore the kingdom to Israel? They didn't know what they were talking about. They hadn't the faintest clue as to what the real nature of the kingdom or the nature of the Messiah was. Now, all of this, as I say, is contained in the gospel records, but it's not explained in the gospel records. I think we'll have to go to the secular writings in order to understand those particular backgrounds and the settings of this time. Now, let's do that. Now, I've made some extra preparation in the terms of research. Now, I want to take leave and ask for your permission to read to you tonight some things that are very important for you to in understanding what the nature of this time was. For example, in these days, there was extreme poverty. One record here, some had become accustomed to it and had accepted it as being becoming. In fact, Rabbi Akiba took an extreme position, saying that poverty is as becoming to the daughter of Jacob as a red strap is on the head of a white horse. If you've ever seen a white horse, beautiful, with a red strap on his face, the rabbi knew what was beautiful. He said poverty is that becoming to the daughter of Jacob. But others thought differently. This man, and I'm reading now from a book called A Social and Religious History of the Jews by Salo Whitmayer Baron, Volume 2, Part 2, and this is on page 46. Other Jews thought differently. They were not ready to submit quietly to the economic ills gnawing at the very life of the people. Not only fugitive slaves, but also miserable free working men often organized bands to attack merchants and other wayfarers. Robbery became a permanent feature of Palestinian life. Even the general pacification of the country by the Herodian and Roman armies failed to eradicate this evil. The persistence of economic distress constantly bred new desperados. But not only was there poverty, there was also this feeling of Roman oppression. And the next quotation is from this same book. These social outcasts soon found a rationale of their own. Some took up arms not merely to help themselves, but to help the whole people. They saw Roman oppression as the embodiment of all evil, invoking the ancient prophecies, heeding the preachments of new prophets. Judas of Galilee and his descendants refused obedience to any earthly monarch. Now, this Judas of Galilee is the man that's referred to in Acts, the 5th chapter, where Gamaliel said, before this happened, there was a man, Judas of Galilee, names him. This man made an insurrection in A.D. 6. The Lord was about 10 years old when Judas led this insurrection against the Roman army. And so they just said, nobody but the Lord God is going to rule over us. All means were justifiable to remove Roman oppression. So we find this thing developing, the economic poverty, and then the Roman oppression. And then thirdly, out of these two factors, there developed this rabid, fervent patriotism that just absolutely lost all bound and went outside all bounds of reason. In this way arose the zealot faction. Now, who were the zealots or the zealots? Does that ring a bell? Didn't Jesus choose one of his disciples, one of the 12 from the zealots? What was his name? Simon. Simon was a zealot. Well, you see, he refers to this faction here. In this way arose the zealotic or the zealot faction, which for decades carried on desperate guerrilla warfare against the Romans. It's in its rationalization, the movement appeared as a special messianic belief that only through an armed uprising sustained by God could the enemy be expelled and God's reign of peace and universal prosperity dawn upon mankind. That's why an extremist wing among them, the Assassins, had no scruples about murdering a Roman official or a Jewish partisan of Rome. Galilee, with its numerous mountain refuges, was the cradle and became the permanent home of these various groups constituting this bellicose sect. The ethnic composition of the province, full of recent converts, and the sharp economic conflicts prevailing there nurtured an undying revolutionary spirit. Are you getting a picture of it? These were the background, or this was the background picture out of which the messianic hope was spawned. Now, this may not be the explanation of the origin of the messianic hope, and it isn't, but it certainly is a description of the present circumstances that cradled the messianic hope at that time that Jesus was living here on the earth. Now, let me read further. In the same book, on page 61, it said almost anyone could engage the attention of a people brought to despair by the overwhelming power of Rome and the dismal domestic situation. Deceivers and impostors, writes Josephus, under the pretense of divine inspiration, fostering revolutionary changes, they persuaded the multitude to act like madmen and led them out into the desert under the belief that God would then give them tokens of deliverance. For example, in about 52 to 54 A.D., now this was about, 20 years after Jesus' death, an Egyptian Messiah appeared and brought 30,000 Jerusalem Jews to the Mount of Olives, declaring that he would show them from hence how at his command the walls of Jerusalem would fall down. Roman soldiers speedily and bloodily suppressed both commotions. You know who that Egyptian revolutionary was? I don't know who he was, but do you know who was accused of being that Egyptian? Remember in Acts, the 21st chapter, when Paul was in Jerusalem and the Jews attacked him? And the Roman army had to go down there and rescue him. And Paul said, can I say something to the crowd? And the man said, do you speak Greek? Are you not then that Egyptian that led so many assassins out into the wilderness? That's who he was talking about. It was a recent event. It was fresh on their minds. And he thought that perhaps Paul was that assassin. This man led 30,000 Jewish assassins out into the wilderness and led them to the city of Jerusalem and claimed that at his command the city walls would fall down. Listen, there are about 1,200 here tonight. Multiply this group by four. That'll give you 48. No, how many? No, my goodness, 30,000. Multiply it by, let's say there's 1,000 here. Multiply it by 30. 30,000 Jews. And then, the rebellion was put down, and you find that it was stopped, at least for temporarily. Listen to this other quotation. This is from a book entitled The Jewish World in the Time of Jesus by C.H., I don't know how to pronounce it, Guinebert, G-U-I-G-N-E-B-E-R-T. He makes the statement, it is no exaggeration to say that just before the birth of Jesus, speculations as to the date and duration of the messianic reign, the coming of the Messiah, the day of Yahweh, the resurrection, and the last judgment were central in Jewish thought, and they occupied the chief place among the politico-religious questions which engaged and engrossed the inhabitants of Palestine. The scribes discussed them in their schools. They were the inspiration of the synagogues, and the common people found in their expectation of what was to come consolation and stimulus, not unmixed with anxiety. Up until this time, interest in the coming of the Messiah does not seem to have been keen, and the Messiah finds no great place in the texts. But this can no longer be said of Jesus' contemporaries or of the following generation. Interest and enthusiasm increased until the time of the great revolt that was in AD 70. A crop of prophets and messiahs arose. And it says there were numerous incidents portending an imminent divine manifestation. When he says a crop of prophets and messiahs arose, he was right. I read somewhere else where there were some 64 false messiahs and false Christs who arose during this period of time. And you see, the background was, it wasn't any religious thing to them. This was a political. They used religious terms to disguise the activities. And they cashed in on the religious expectations of people in the coming of the Messiah. But these men were trying to get out from under the oppression of the Roman Empire. The most convincing proof of the practical importance of messianism about the time of Jesus is the state of emotional upheaval persisting in Israel, a state which would otherwise be quite unmotivated and which can only be explained by the messianic hope. During the century which preceded the birth of Jesus, and still more during the two centuries which followed, this state of unrest gave rise to various popular movements of more or less importance, which did serious harm to the Jewish nation and led at last to its final downfall. Each visionary who arose, each rebel who incited Israel to take up arms, could count on a following who would be ready to hail him as the long-awaited Messiah. And you see, these things were just popping up all over the country. Everywhere you looked, a new Messiah was coming up. And you're going to have to read the New Testament in the light of this very decided and definite historical coloring. Whenever it says that Barabbas, you know what it says about Barabbas? You know why Barabbas was in prison? He had murdered during an insurrection, during an uprising. He had committed murder. And Mark, in Mark 15 and chapter and verse 7, describes this man as a murderer, as an insurrectionist who had committed murder during the insurrection. And there must have been one right recently that was called the insurrection. And so you find not only Judas and Thutis mentioned in Acts the 5th chapter, and you find the Egyptian who was the leader of the assassins, whom Paul was accused of being in Acts the 21st chapter. And then you find the reference here to Barabbas, who was an insurrectionist and had committed murder. You find all these. It's just one fermenting reference to upheaval. And you have to take it into consideration. That was the tenor of the times. And that was the messianic hope. That was the coloring of it. Well, there are other major incidents. Incidentally, they weren't any different back then than the Jews are today. What's the rescue they completed lately? In Tibby. Well, that's just like them. Man alive. Desperados, daring. That's the way they were here. Look, let me tell you about some times. I know we're going to run over tonight. Y'all can get these other men. I forgot to tell them that I had some material that just has to be told. Look, I wish you'd been with me on April the 17th, 1970. We went to bed that night. We were down by the Sea of Galilee, my wife and three sons. We were in a hut, a grass hut, sleeping in a little campground on the Sea of Galilee by the shore. And about 2 o'clock in the morning on April the 17th, there came all these vehicles blowing horns and yelling and shouting and singing and chanting and... Well, we woke up, of course, and that continued for 3 more hours. Finally, at 5 o'clock, I got up, took the tape recorder, and went down and tried to find the leader of that confusion. And I found him, and I said, tell me, what's going on? Something was very important, I could tell. And he said, oh, this is a group of 90 boy and girl scouts, and they've just completed a 75-kilometer trek, and they've come now to this campground, and we're going to now hear their final pledge. I said, oh, that's very interesting. He said, in the morning, we're going to go up here, and he pointed back over to his right. He said, we're going to go back over here to Mount Arabel, and we're going to go up in there and see the ruins of that fort. He said, would you like to go with us? And I said, I certainly would. So about 6 o'clock in the morning, we all piled on the buses and went back a long way, back around the back side of that thing, and drove up the slope of it, not up the face of it. You couldn't get up the face. And this Jew told the story of how about 47 B.C., and this was only one of the times. I learned that in the middle of the 2nd century B.C., around 160 B.C., that Judas Maccabeus had held up in that same cave city. They had dug out all this back in there. They had a literal city back in there. They had their storehouses. They had the granaries. They had the place where they ate and where they cooked and where they kept their arms. And we walked all up in there and saw all of this great fortification back up there that had been used as far back as Judas Maccabeus in the middle of the 2nd century B.C. And then it was used in about 47 B.C. by Herod, or it was attacked by Herod as he tried to regain his place of king over the Jewish people. But there was a diehard bunch of, I don't know how many hundred were in there, But they held up until finally most of them were killed by Herod's army, which was the Roman army. And then Herod extended more or less, not amnesty, but he said, come on, give up, we don't want to kill you. And one old man, as Josephus records it, had seven sons and his wife in there. And the old man was begged by his wife and seven children, let's go out and live. And the old man said, all right, you all come one at a time, and I'm going to stand at the mouth of the cave, and you can go out. And as they came, each one, Josephus says, this man ran his sword through each one of his own children, and their dead bodies fell, and he'd throw them aside. He'd call another one, another one would come, and all seven of them, he ran his sword through them. And when his wife came, he ran his sword through that woman. And then Herod, seeing what was happening, said, old man, don't. And then the old man turned around and started cursing Herod. And he finally, after killing all seven children and his wife and throwing their dead bodies over this precipice, he then himself jumped headlong and killed himself. That's the kind of fanaticism those people were capable of. That's the kind of fanaticism that has always characterized those people. Political people, people who were patriots, people who were leading always political uprisings, that's the kind of people they were. That's the kind of people Jesus had to deal with. Then again, in about 132 to 135, what is known as the Barkaba Rebellion. Now that took place down northeast of the Sea of the Dead Sea, just north of the last one that I'll mention, the Masada. But Barkaba Rebellion took place in about 135. It was squelched by the Romans again with much bloodshed. But I suppose the one that's the most outstanding is the one known as the rebellion at Masada. The Masada is it's a huge mountain, a flat-topped mountain. It's a bulwark there standing on the east or western side of the Sea of the Dead Sea. And you'd cry, you'd literally weep if you were to read the account of it. 960 of these patriots stored up provisions and arms and all the things that were necessary, water, stored these things up, 960 of them. That included the men who were the warriors, the reactionaries, and their wives and children. They held up in that mountain stronghold for some 2 years while the Romans were assaulting them and trying to build a road up to that mountain to where they could get their armaments up there, their battering rams. Finally, after about 2 years, they succeeded. They got the battering rams and their war machines up there, and they rammed in the walls of that fortress. And those people, seeing that the end was near, made a death pact among themselves and decided that they would all be killed before they would surrender. And so as the time of the Romans coming in was imminent, these people executed their plot. All of the men, each one, killed his own wife and children. And then, of all the men, after they had killed their own wives and children, this is a matter of history. Josephus records it in detail. And there's a long speech given by the leader of this group that shows the fanatical zeal of these people. So each one killed his own wife and children. And then they chose 10 men to then go through and slay all the other men. And then they drew straws, and one man was chosen to kill the other nine. And then this last man, as he looked over and saw that everyone was dead, fell on his own sword and took his own life. 960 people died. There was one woman and three or four children that hid in a little crevice and came out and told the Romans what had happened. That's the kind of people they were. That's the kind of people that existed at the time of Christ. That's why this event here had such an important place in the ministry of Jesus Christ. Now, what happened in John 6, 1 through 15? Well, what happened was the feeding of the 5,000, yes. The mindset of these people, though, was messianic. But when I say messianic, don't let me convey the thought that it was spiritually messianic. That wasn't it. These people were out there as a group of revolutionaries, not at Jesus' instigation. He didn't want them out there for that reason. But the whole national mindset was on this subject. You couldn't have had a different setting than this. Not at that time. The men who came out were definitely determined to make Jesus Christ their ruler, their king. They were going to make him their leader, and they were going to have an insurrection, and they were going to throw the Romans out of the country. I'm as confident of that as I am that I'm standing here. The mindset of the Jews at that time who met with Jesus out there in the wilderness was definitely messianic. Matthew and Mark and Luke and John record that there were 5,000 men involved in that meeting. Mark, Luke, and John say that there were men. Matthew says that there was no, this doesn't count the women and children. But the Greek term there can be translated as well as not counting women and children, it can be translated with no admixture of women and children, that there were just men there, which has very strong backing from the sense that Mark, Luke, and John don't mention that there were any women at all. It doesn't even mention it at all. But Matthew says without the admixture of women and children, that may be exactly what it means. So you find this setting, and you find that they came then by force to take him and make him king. So all of this together, the fact that this is contained in all four Gospels, the fact of his force that he used to get his disciples to get out of there, to get in that boat and leave, the fact that he dismissed the mob, he went up into the hills to pray, he then came back again, and there was this separation between him and the people. And from that point on, the popularity of Jesus began to wane, and his position among the people began to be very precarious. You couldn't really count on it. And that's what is mentioned in the 66th verse of this 6th chapter of John, when it says, when the people saw these things, when they heard these things, it says that many of his disciples went back and walked with him no more. And that's when Jesus turned to his 12 and said, are you going to leave too? And they said, Lord, to whom shall we go? You have the words of everlasting life. Now, I tried to decide what to bring to you from the 6th chapter of John. As you can see, we didn't get much into the 6th chapter, but I'm just simply saying that this is the setting. This is the setting, the messianic hope that had such a grasp on the people at that time was purely a political messianic hope. It was nationalistic. It was revolutionary. It took upon itself the form of uprisings and insurrections. People were guilty of murder. They were guilty of all of these things that you can see. Poverty reigned almost supreme among the common people. And the oppression of the Romans and all of this, you see, added together. That's why it's so important that we understand the circumstances as we see this event in John the 6th chapter. The feeding of the 5,000 men. Their attempt, or their very near attempt, Jesus thwarted it. When he knew that they were coming to make him king by force, he dismissed his disciples, went up into the hills to pray. That's why it's so important that we see this. This is the background of chapter 6 of John's gospel. So we find a man that, in essence, said, my kingdom is not of this world. Now, he had made that decision in his temptation back in Matthew 4. He's reaffirming it now. I'm not that kind of a king. You've got the wrong man. Cool it. I'm not going that direction. I said, okay, suit yourself, but we don't want you unless you go that direction. He said, that's your business. This is where it stands. This is where I am. And if you want me, you're going to have to take me like I am. I have not come to do your will or the will of man. I've come to do the will of my Father. He said, I haven't even come to do my own will. I'm here to do the will of my Father. Man, I'll tell you what. You don't turn 5,000 revolutionaries away without having some strength of character. You know it? You don't send 5,000 revolutionaries with blood in their eye. You don't turn them away without some real strength of character. But you don't turn them away either without a real cost. But that was all right. Jesus was determined to do the will of God regardless of what the cost was. And this was one of them. May God bless us. Get in there and find out about him. He's the most fantastic character that ever lived on the face of the earth. May God bless us as we study about him. Now here, tonight, you may be here and you may be a Christian already. Then enhance and enrich your faith. But if you're not a Christian, perhaps not enough has been said tonight to make you come to belief. But if in your process of growth and development you've come to faith to the point now where you want to express it in your words, where you want to turn your back on sin and come and be baptized into Jesus Christ, if you're at that point, this is your time right now while we stand and sing.